Hello, welcome everyone to the Journey to Success Radio Network. Our purpose on JTS Radio is to interview people who are making a positive difference in the world with transformational businesses, thoughts, ideas, and actions that encourage and inspire. Hello, my name is Taylor Tack. I am a forgiveness educator and coach certified by the Midwest Institute for Forgiveness Training and a certified Napoleon Hill Foundation leadership instructor. I teach people precisely how to let go of hurt and resentments, both big and small, releasing emotional pain and suffering to experience a lasting peace, freedom, and personal success. To find out more about my work and learn how to let go of resentment and suffering in a few easy steps, please visit me at TheEvolvingHeart.com and sign up for a free coaching session. And now to today's success story. My guest today is Dr. Mary McDonald. And Dr. McDonald is the founder and CEO of MCB Partners, which is a national consulting company that provides a broad range of services for educational consulting and models for success. MCB Partners provides education consulting, leadership mentoring, retreats, motivational speeches, and faith-based inspirational presentations. Dr. McDonald has received national acclaim as an innovative educator, author, and public speaker. She has a professional educator for 36 years as a teacher, principal, and most recently as superintendent of Catholic schools for the Diocese of Memphis for 14 years. She also hosts a weekly radio show on AM 990 called Seize the Day with Mary McDonald. Dr. McDonald has been a featured speaker at the White House Summit on Urban Education and a keynote speaker at the 2012 National Catholic Educational Association Convention. She's also the author of two books. Her first book, A Light Reflected, was published in 2003, and History of God, published in 2011. She's written numerous columns and articles for several local and national publications. And Dr. McDonald has joined us today on Journey to Success Radio to tell us how important the education system is to the growth of our children and how you can make a difference in your child's life today. So a very special welcome to Dr. Mary McDonald. Dr. McDonald, how are you today?
I am fine. Taylor, how are you doing?
I'm doing wonderful. I'm doing great. We're really good to have you on Journey to Success Radio, and we're thrilled that you're here. We know that you are a national consultant for education, and so if you can give our listening audience just the general background of how you started in education and how you got involved in that.
Oh, it's been a really an amazing journey, Taylor. I started out as a teacher. I started out teaching in a high school in Philadelphia. I taught math, algebra, geometry a long time ago. And from there, when we moved to Memphis, I taught in grade school, high school, and then became a principal. I was the principal of two different schools here in Memphis. And then after quite some time doing that, which I loved being in those schools, then I became superintendent. So I guess I've come up through the system, you could say, and so I've learned every bit. But in my soul, in my heart, I just am a teacher. And so it's that everything that I learn, I just want to teach it to other people. So as I have learned things along the way, that's what I've done in starting this MCD Partners, is I've learned a lot. And I've learned what to do and what not to do. And I thought, what better way can I give back now than to teach the things I've learned to others who would like to move on in their profession or in their lives? And that includes my talks that I give, a lot of retreats and talks to parents or women. I do some work with empowering women to be the best they can be, but also parents. I just recently gave a talk to parents this week. And it's really difficult for them, too, and there's a lot of, you know, pitfalls along the way. So all the things that I have learned, that's what I'd like to do now, is just to teach them.
Well, that's wonderful, and I think teaching parents is great because they're the direct link to our children, and our children are our future, you know, the basis of our own future. Now tell me about your work in the Memphis Catholic Diocese and the schools as a superintendent. You did a lot of great things in your tenure there. You opened 8 Jubilee Catholic schools that had been closed or schools in poor areas that have been closed for a long time. Tell me a little bit about that and what led to that reopening.
When I accepted the position of superintendent, I really wasn't sure, to be honest with you, what a superintendent does. I mean, what do they do? But I didn't think it sounded like very hard, so I thought, well, I've seen superintendents. I think I can do that. But I didn't really realize until I spoke to the bishop who appointed me superintendent in 1998. Let me see, was it 98? That the job was so widespread and encompassing, and there were a lot of issues. And we were facing, at that time in Memphis, we had about 14 Catholic schools. We didn't have any schools in the inner city or any Catholic schools. They had all been closed anywhere from, I think it was 5 to 57 years. And so they were long gone, and we had some failing schools, some very fragile schools in the outer city area. And we also needed new schools in the suburban areas where many of our Catholic population had moved, but there weren't enough seats for schools in the schools there. So there was like a three-phase issue going on, the inner city, the outer city, and the suburbs. But the bishop, Bishop Saib, who appointed me, he really saw the value of having a presence of Catholic schools in the inner city. And the goal was to have a school come back, or opened or reopened. We never really thought about the reopening, but to have that presence of Catholic education in the inner city. And he added, which was probably pretty much true for Catholic schools everywhere, that we had no money. And so my charge, the vision he wanted me to implement at that time was to bring Catholic education back to the inner city and to find a way to do that. So that's what he thought we should start with first. And it's true, you really need to address the needs of the people who need it the most, who are most in crisis, and that's in our inner city. In Memphis at that time, there were many schools who were on the failing school list. The children were not necessarily receiving the best education that they could be receiving. There were other issues in the inner city with hunger and gangs and violence and burnout buildings, crack houses, all the things, all the atrocities that go along with poverty and children and families who live in poverty. And there seems to be no way out. Well, there is really a way out, and it's through a good, solid education that can help open doors for you. So that was the goal, to see if we could come back to the inner city. At that same time, there were people in Memphis, people who were very dedicated and devoted to making Memphis the best it could be, who saw the need for education in the inner city. So as God often does, he puts people together who share a common vision. We have, in Catholic schools, we have the vehicle that can bring people out of poverty, and it's education. And we do it amazingly well and have done it for centuries amazingly well. So through the grace of God and some wonderful interviews and people, and I mostly spent the first year of my tenure speaking about Catholic education, talking to groups and individuals and businesses, foundations, anyone who would listen about the importance and what we could do to bring that alive again in the inner city. So after about 10 months, I got the first offer of someone, a group who would help us, give us the seed money to start reopening. First it was one Catholic school, and one led to six, and six led to eight, and we're always up for the challenge, so we just kept saying yes. And I really feel that this was God's plan. We were just working it. We were blessed to be able to get this opportunity. At the same time, across the country, in every diocese, there was a crisis in Catholic education, and schools were closing by the hundreds. And it's not that some of them should not have been closed, but the unfortunate thing is they were closing in a wholesale way in the inner cities. The children who needed it most were being shut out, and it was strictly because of the finances. It's not because people didn't want them to be there, but they didn't have the means to support it. And here we were in Memphis, very small diocese, very limited in resources, only a 4% Catholic population, and we were reopening schools. So this became referred to as like the miracle in Memphis, because it was a miracle. But
absolutely.
And the, most of the people, in fact, in the beginning, the donors, the benefactors who really choose to remain anonymous because it's all about the kids, that's what they say, it's all about them, the children, not about them, are not Catholic. They're very faith-filled people, but not Catholic, but they saw the value of Catholic education. So in the school year, 99-2000, we began to reopen them. And at that time, because it was a jubilee year coming up in 2000 and we were reopening these schools, the bishop and I discussed a name for them, and he thought Jubilee would be great, because, and it is a great name, because of the Jubilee schools. And so that's what they became. At the time, we really weren't thinking about how big it would become or how marketing the name would be important. We were just thinking about a name for this one little school. And each school retained its original name and still was housed at the parish. It was where it was located. But as they reopened, they became known as the Jubilees. We started with one. And in order to implement it in a way that everyone would understand why we were there and why we were back, we just reopened one school a year with one grade. So the first year we started with a kindergarten class in one school, St. Augustine. And then the next year it was we reopened two schools and then added a first grade to the first school. So every year we did that until now all eight schools are reopened and they all have their full complement of grades that they will have. And they're doing well. They're, you know, in the beginning, maybe not in the beginning, maybe always, there were so many people who said it will never work. It will never. Why are you doing this? This is crazy. This is a mistake. The money could be used for something else, something better. And we couldn't think of anything better than educating children in poverty. And the people who gave the funds, that's what they gave them for that education of children in the inner city, urban areas who are living in poverty. So we were true to that mission, and we reopened the schools. We didn't realize, though, how deep poverty is in the city and how widespread illiteracy is and how much violence and abuse and neglect and lack of structure that the children live with, and many of them don't really have a permanent address. And we just didn't understand that that what we fed them at school, which we thought would be a lunch, a nice lunch, would be the only thing that they would eat until the next day when they returned. So there were so many other issues that we began to immediately address. We would probably have to provide them with uniforms to wear to school, but then we realized we had to put washers and dryers in the schools to make sure that everything was clean and ready to wear, so they would have several sets and bring things in. So there's so many other things, health care, vision care, dental care, counseling, social work. There are so many layers that we, every year, we seem to be adding more layers of support to the children and families. Something that we really hadn't done. We just had Catholic schools in areas, mostly in the parishes where the children could afford to go, and they were part of that parish. But when we opened our doors to particularly children in poverty, we accepted the responsibility then of addressing the needs of the children. So all of our support grew. And the involvement of, I cannot begin to tell you, the number of people, organizations, businesses, institutions that all came together, not even to mention the teachers and principals and the people who were at the schools. So many people have come together to make this happen and to see it through and to keep it going and to really, and everybody has a great idea. People would come and say, why don't we do this? And it sounded like, that's a great idea. And we also had to build the infrastructure in the Catholic schools office to handle this increased load. During my tenure there, we went from the 14 schools to 29, which was adding a great deal to the infrastructure, so we had to make sure that was in place, as well as succession planning, emerging leadership, making sure we were training people for leadership, and always making sure everybody was part of the vision, part of the movement, part of everything that was happening, so that they could understand it. So it's really, it was definitely, we were very entrepreneurial for about 8 years, and then we wanted to move into that professional management stage. But it was great. It was great because it was, you never knew what was happening next. You just knew that it was all part of a bigger plan. And the more people that you involve in whatever it is you're doing, the more chances you have for success. So we just opened it up to, oh, we had so many people helping in so many different ways, like tutoring and helping with food and clothes and working with the families and the children. And I just can't even begin to tell you all the different ways. So in a nutshell, that's what we did.
Sounds like you created an entire infrastructure for areas of the city that really, really needed it. And I know that you do that now with education consulting and consulting with other dioceses and other education systems on how they can improve their own education system.
Well, and that happened, it's, again, I think this is, for me anyway, I'll say this has been a journey, because after all the schools were up and running and doing well and things were, we had money in the bank, we're just kind of moving right along, and it was at the point where we were really having everything in place in terms of professional management. And I did, all through the years, get calls from other places wondering what they could do and how they could do it. And I would talk to them and tell them. But the year that the students that started that kindergarten class in 1999 graduated from high school, and they were so successful in their lives, so different, so changed. And it was, for me, it was almost like seeing something full circle. I've seen this happen and come to life, and it was living and improving, and here these kids were moving on, going to colleges, great universities. So I felt, and then I was getting more and more interest from other people, so I felt that I had to make a decision as to what to do next. This was up and running and good. And so that's when I decided that, all right, I will take that leap of faith and there and see what I could do to help others. And that's how it started, was to helping these 14 inner-city schools in Philadelphia to implement a similar, because nothing is exactly the same, in their own way implement a model of coming together as a group of schools, which they call the Independent Mission Schools, and bringing life back to those inner-city Catholic schools. So that's, I started with them about a year and a half ago, and they're up and running and doing well. In the last year, I've been in about 67, almost 70 cities, either helping them work with shoring up existing schools or how to reopen and revitalize inner-city schools, or just giving speeches or talks to help motivate people to seeing the great part that they play in education and enlisting their community. So I just kind of jumped off and jumped into something that has been equally as busy, and I love it. And I just do. I love it.
That's great. And you're such an inspiration to those of us who see you and watch your work. Dr. McDonald, I just want to honor you for that. I did want to touch a little bit on faith, because I know that faith played a huge part in your ability to take on what you did over your career. And you got an interesting story about the arms of God. Can you give a little bit to our listeners about what happened with the arms of God?
I will, because really this whole thing has been about faith. And believe me, I know. I was there. No human being could have done these things. No group of human beings could have done any of this without God's divine intervention and instilling the faith and the wisdom to know what to do into all of us who were doing it. But when the bishop told me about this plan, or his vision to bring education back to the inner city, and he talked about shoring up other schools, but it was really important in the inner city. And then he said, we had no money, and I'm sitting there thinking, I don't know about this. This is like, but I didn't say that to him. I just said, okay. And then I left his office, and I went to the chapel in the Catholic center where I worked, and there is an altar there, and over the altar is a crucifix, and the figure of Christ on the cross, his arms are outstretched. And I got down on my knees and I prayed and I said, God, I can't do this job. There is no way. I don't even know what a superintendent does. I have no idea how even to begin. This is not for me. I said, I've got to get out of this. I can't do this job. And I just knew I couldn't. There was no way I could do that. And but then I thought about the children, and as I was praying, I said, I sort of got angry at God, and I said, well, you know, this is right. We should be in the inner city. We should be taking care of these children, but this is way above anything I can do. And really, it's your job. And I looked at Christ on the cross, and I said, you know, and if you really love these children, you would find a way to wrap your arms around them and help them and lift them up, because this is what your job is. This is not my job. But for me right now, it feels like you don't even have any arms. And I left. And I mean, how arrogant is that? to Scott, like not having any arms and not doing his job. So I left, and I went back to my office, and I started fixing it up, do these little things, and meet with people and talk about things. And I didn't really, it was in the back of my mind, but I thought, there's no way, so I'm not even going to worry about this. And a month later, I was at a meeting in San Diego of superintendents. Superintendents across the country come together once a year, and we meet, and I'm thinking to myself, well, this is more like it. I'm a superintendent, I should go to a meeting and talk to other people. And I did, and part of the meeting consisted in one night of going to Mass at a mission, one of the old missions in San Diego. And after Mass, we would go have dinner in the hall there. And so I went, and I was waiting for Mass to start, and I was kneeling there in front of the, in the pews with the others. And I looked up, and there, over the altar, hung a 7-foot crucifix. And the figure of Christ on the altar had no arms. Well, all of a sudden, what I said a month ago at the Catholic Center came back to me, and I went, oh, my heaven. I said, oh, I accused God of not having any arms, and here is this crucifix hanging there with no arms. I'm thinking, surely, this is not my fault. You know, I didn't do this, but there's a message in this somewhere. So after Mass, I went up, and I asked the priest, and I said, why is there a broken crucifix over the altar? And he looked at me, and he said, well, he said, he had found that crucifix in the shop, and it was so beautiful and so finely carved. It was a very old crucifix, and it was beautiful. The wood was carved beautifully. And he said he decided to buy it and have it fixed up and have the arms replaced and bring it and hang it in the mission. But when he bought it back, the sisters who worked at the mission there convinced him to hang it just as it is, without the arms, as a reminder for anyone who saw it, that we are God's arms in the world and must do his work. Well, like I was fainted. I thought, oh, my gosh. I came all the way out to San Diego to get a message, and I just felt like it was a postcard from God to me that said, I don't have the job you do. Now go back to Memphis and do it. So then it was like everything just changed for me, and I went back to Memphis, and I was convinced that this is what God wanted us to do. This was a journey of faith and trust. And so that's when I began to talk to everybody and tell everybody what we wanted to do and try to get people to jump on board with us and convince people that this was important for the children. And there was really 10 months to the day of that I got the first call from those wonderful, amazing donors who decided to join us and jump on board and support us by giving us the seed money to start. But that's really not the end of the story. That carried us through. That carried me through. I just was convinced. I mean, when you are on fire with something that you feel called to do, it doesn't matter if they throw accolades or tomatoes, you're going to do it.
And that's so, right. Burned it there.
Yeah, and so I was, and people were telling me all the time, this is not work. This never worked. This is not going to be. There was an article that was written in a local paper, the kind of paper that wants to get it to the real story. And it said that I was crazy and that this would never work. And they found everybody, actually I think they found all every Catholic they could who thought it was a bad idea so they can quote them in the paper. But and I keep that paper today to motivate me to keep doing things that people say can't be done. But it was difficult. And as I told you, we found that it was much harder than we ever imagined. And the children were so much needier than we ever could have dreamt. The conditions in which they and their families lived, the intergenerational poverty, I can't tell you. Plus people, there were lots of waves of people who kept saying it wasn't going to work, you'll never find people to teach in those schools, or where are these kids you're talking about? But we kept on going, and more people believed that this is God's plan and joined with us to make it happen. And it was happening. And so we had something to point at and say, well, if it's not working, what are these kids doing here learning? So we moved on. And we did find people to teach in the schools and to do the work, and the teachers were just amazing. They still are. They're amazing, and the principals. And then here we were at year five. It was year five, and we were opening school number seven. And it was Holy Names, and really probably in the worst part of the city. I can't even describe it. It was an area of buildings and crack houses and abandonment, but yet people lived there and were very, very needy. And so the school was being opened. The thing about this was nobody ever thought we would be there, but there we were. And it was the day before the school opened that the principal was showing me all around the school, and it was amazing. This school had been closed for 57 years.
Wow.
And yet when we came back, it just was like a time warp. It was like looking at a school, you know, that was like from the 60s, you know, from the 40s and 50s. But it was in good shape. It was built like a bomb shelter. So basically it needed some rewiring and some barcode things, violations that might, or fixing up anything that could have been a fire code violation. But by and large, it was just needed some cosmetic things. So he was showing me around the school, and the paint was just barely dry, and everything was great, and he was so proud of it. And so we were going into all the classrooms, and each one he went into, he would say, I can't wait till the kids get here. We're going to do this. We're going to do this. And he was getting very, very excited with each room. And I knew the kids who were coming. I knew what he would be facing. I knew what the teachers would be facing. I knew what the families faced. I mean, I knew what was happening. At that point, you know, reality just kind of hit me in the face. I knew what was happening. And everything did cost more than we thought. And we were always, you know, looking for more donations and more money and more ways to get this done. So with every room we went into, he got more excited, and I began to get more and more discouraged. And I'd never felt like this before. And by the time we got to the gym, which was the last place he showed me, I was really in a panic mode. Internally, it was like I was thinking, oh, my heavens, how can I stop this? How can I get out of it? Maybe I'll just, like, die. Maybe this will go away. it was like, oh, my heavens, this might be a huge mistake. And here we are in the midst of it, 5 years down the road with all these people counting on us. And where will we get the money? And all those things, those negative things, all kind of just, like, fell on top of my head. And so we were in the gym, and I had never doubted before, but we were in the gym, and he was excited, and I looked over, and there at the end of the gym was a stage, and on either side was a door. So I said, Dee, his name is Dee Hour, I said, Dee, what's behind those doors? And he said, he says, the stairs to the attic, just some stuff that was left there when the school closed. I said, well, I was like thinking, we need everything we can get. I said, well, what's the stuff? He said, well, you know, I really don't know. I haven't gone up there yet. And so I said, well, let's go and see what we can find. So with that, he opened the door to the stairs, and I looked up the steps, and there, leaning against the wall of the attic, was a 7-foot crucifix, and the figure of Christ on the cross had no arms. Well, I almost passed out at that time. It was like, I did. I needed it. I just sort of fell against the wall and looked the door and looked up, And he looked at me, and he looked at the crucifix, and he looked at me, and he looked at the crucifix, and he looked at me, and he said, I didn't do it, because he saw the look on my face. And I said, oh, no, Dee, you don't understand. And I said, I quickly told him about finding the other crucifix and knowing that we're supposed to be God's arms. And look, I said, here. I said, look, hidden away in the attic of a Jubilee school for 57 years is a crucifix, and the figure of Christ has no arms. And I said, don't you see, it's a postcard. It's another postcard from God. And it says, having a difficult time, wish you were here. And we are here, and we are God's arms, and this is what we're supposed to be doing. And so I just knew it. Ever since that day, I never doubted again. I never doubted. I didn't worry about where the money was coming from. I didn't worry about who was coming. I just knew that these children needed us, and we were there, and we were going to stay there, and we were going to keep on going. And so that kind of has been the lesson for my life, for everything else that has come since seeing that crucifix. And I think sometimes, what would have ever happened if we didn't go back? That someday when they tore down that building, they would find that up in the attic was a crucifix, and the figure of Christ had no arms, and that would mean nothing to them. They would just kind of haul it away. And the funny thing is, they never did find the arms anywhere in the attic. So I'm thinking to myself, somehow that crucifix was waiting for someone to open that door. So.
What a wonderful story. What a beautiful story. And over my own life, that, you know, our success is based on not what happens to us, but the meanings we associate to what happens to us in our lives and the meaning we give us. And I know that that crucifix has meant so much to you and your life and your work, you know, in the inner city of Memphis and opening schools and raising children up and helping them have a more successful and happy life. Let me ask you, Mary, just a quick question about all the success that you've had and the things that you've learned for teachers who are listening to the program or educators out there, or just for anyone else who's listening.
Yeah.
What are some of a couple of tips that you can give to them on taking the next step in whatever they're facing or whatever they're going through right now?
You know, it's one thing I have learned, and this really does carry you through just really anything, any situation, regardless of how disastrous it seems at the time or how you think it's going to be easy and it turns out to be, like, really hard. Like, I thought teaching was supposed to be easy until I started teaching. But one thing is that you learn, it's not about you. It's just not about you. It's about others. And I remember when I first started teaching, I thought, okay, it's like I'm the teacher and this is what everybody's going to do. Until I learned that it wasn't about me. It was about how I was supposed to bring out the best in others. I was supposed to recognize gifts and talents that other people had, that my success as a teacher was directly linked to the success of my students. That if they learned, if they discovered, if they became better in many, many different ways, then that was what I was supposed to do. It wasn't about raising me up as a teacher. It was about raising them up. And that is the same message that you can do regardless of what you're doing. For me, as a principal, a superintendent, whatever, it was never about what I was doing. It was about finding ways to empower others to be the best they can be, finding ways to bring out some of these hidden talent or to recognize something, to encourage people. And basically that's what I find myself doing, which is why I love what I'm doing now. I don't really tell people how to do their jobs, but I encourage them to dig deep within themselves to find what it is that they can bring to their jobs that will help others. And so it's always about making other people better at doing what they're doing. I don't think people realize how great they are and how much they can do. I think sometimes somewhere along the way people, they were known maybe for what they couldn't do. Oh, he can't do that. Or, you know, she's not really able to do that. Instead of being known for what they can do or the potential that they have in them. I mean, when I was in first grade, if you asked if you could, I don't know if she's still living, but if you could resurrect her and ask her, if she thought I would be doing what I'm doing now, she'd probably say, are you kidding? you know, she didn't pay attention. I was trying to teach her how to make letters, and she was looking at the kids next to her. So, you know, it's always about the potential that other people help you bring out or develop. So I just feel like that's been my real calling, my real passion, is not about being successful at this, that, or the other thing, but about helping others to achieve their success. I really just get a kick out of seeing a former student who is now, like, doing brain surgery or a firefighter, or, you know, doing something that I knew way down deep when they were little they loved doing. Or I see a principal. One of the things I really am excited about is, nine of the people I had hired or had promoted to positions of authority as principal or assistant superintendents or things like that while I was superintendent are now in the position of superintendent or assistant superintendent in other here or in other dioceses. I mean, I've been in, I think, six other dioceses in the country have superintendents or assistant superintendents who are former principals in Memphis. So, like, I'm so excited about their success. And that was always my goal, is developing leadership in others. And I love to delegate and trust. Just, you know, give somebody a job and tell them, you believe in them. Believe they can do it. And you know what?
Wow.
They do it. So I'm excited about the leadership that's out there, you know.
Delegate and trust. What a beautiful message. Now, you're also encourage and inspire people in other ways, too. You have a weekly radio show on AM990 in Memphis called Seize the Day. Tell us about that.
Well, that's another one of those things that just may happen, you know. Just like when somebody said, want to be a teacher, I said, sure, how hard can that be? So I was asked to consider having a radio show. Well, basically, the only thing I ever did on the air, so to speak, was like announcements on the PA in school. But so I thought to myself, sure, how hard can that be? You know, sure, I'll do it. Well, then I did a radio show and found out how hard it can be, and all that goes into it prior to that 1 hour a week that you hear. But it was okay because my goal in the show was not to deliver my message, but to provide a forum for people to deliver their messages and inspire others to do. Taylor, just what you're doing, really, that's what you do. You give people a forum to you know, share their message and encourage them. So that's what I wanted to do, and I have enjoyed doing it.
Oh, wonderful.
It's hard. It's a lot harder
than it is hard. But well worth the efforts.
Yes, it is.
To make it work.
Fun, too. It's fun to just sit and talk to people. And you do. Actually, you really do forget that there's people listening, so you just keep talking.
That's right. You're a multiple author. You've written two books, one, A Light Reflected, in 2003, and A History of God in 2011. Coincidentally, the same year as I wrote my books, which is pretty awesome.
So
that is weird. Tell us about your two books, if you would.
Because I was writing a regular column for a newspaper, and I wasn't writing. I know I'm an educator by profession, but you know, I've never let my job define who I am. You know, people say, "Oh, you're the superintendent." I said, "No, that's just a job I have right now." Who you are is so much more than what you do at any particular time in your life. You use what you do to develop who you are. That's the way I look at it. So the columns I was writing were more spiritual, inspirational, directed mostly to parents because I was so familiar with working with parents and knew how difficult their job is and wanted to help and maybe motivate and inspire them. So it started out with that. But then I realized when people would, you know, talk about the different columns with me, that there are other issues out there. People are dealing with workplace issues, bullying issues, people who've lost jobs and people who had betrayals in their life and people who had all kinds of negative experiences and all kinds of dysfunction in their life that they were trying to either live with or overcome or get beyond. And so the columns took a more of a turn of, being a spiritual message for people who worry, but in a very kind of down-to-earth, common sense, using everyday language way, if you know what I mean.
Sure.
So then someone suggested that I wanted to put them in a book because I keep losing the ones I cut out. So that's what happened. And then I got a call from Notre Dame, University of Notre Dame, and they wanted to publish, wanted to know if I would write some more and publish a book that was like that. So all of the articles or the little chapters in the book are no more than like 2 pages, maybe a little more, 2.5 pages. So there's some, they're like quick inspirational reads or meditations kind of thing. But the second one, A History with God, is really about a person's, what they don't realize they have is their history, their faith journey, their spiritual awakenings, and how that happens within the context of family or workplace or just in their personal lives. So that's, it's just everyday stories about things that happen to people and how you can turn them around.
Oh, wonderful. That's wonderful.
I do. And it's funny because once you have that desire to do that kind of writing, I write now for a newspaper in Memphis that I guess it's supposed to be more like business writing, like about different businesses and opportunities in Memphis, but I've somehow found the people in Memphis who have businesses that are lifting up people, not just, you know, selling something, but lifting people up by the work they do. So once you have that desire to do that, and no matter what you do, it's going to sound like that. So that's what I do.
Well, you do a wonderful job of that. And if you want to contact Mary, get in touch with her, you can look at her website, which is mcd-partners.com, and you find out all about Mary and the great work that she does. Where can people purchase your books, Mary?
They can purchase them on Amazon.com, or they can purchase them at at Notre Dame on their website, or they can go to my website. I think it's Notre Dame is. I'm looking for their website, but anyway, they can go to MCD-Partners. Don't forget the little dash in there. .com. And or they can. That's probably the easiest way. Or actually, the book itself has a website. It's a Facebook page and a website, History with God. And they can do that, or they can go to nd.ace.edu or nd.edu or the Notre Dame bookstore.
Okay, wonderful.
Or Amazon's easy.
Wonderful. Yeah, Amazon's easy for a lot of people.
Yeah.
Let me ask you this, Mary, which is, as we kind of wrap up this interview, what really drives you to be successful? You've done a wonderful job of explaining to us your career in education. And what is it every day that makes you get up and just want to encourage, inspire, and help other people? What is it about it that drives you?
I think it's the excitement of what's next. Somebody asked me recently, like, what accomplishment have you? Did you do that? Are you most proud of? And I thought about it, and I said, like, well, the next one. It's always about what can I do now? You challenge yourself to be that best version of yourself. It's like, okay, now what can I do? It's like you go through phases. At a time, I think that most people in my age group are thinking about doing nothing or doing very little. I keep thinking it's not over yet. What else can I do? You know, who needs something now that I could possibly help them with? So what motivates me is not necessarily the achievement of something, but how can I make myself better? How can I do my best? What can I do now? If I did this, okay, I did that, and I did this, okay. What can I do now? I don't think it's ever over for anybody. I don't care what kind of circumstances you find yourself in. And I know that for a fact because about 9 years ago I had a stroke. So I speak now to the stroke clubs to encourage the people who have had strokes that it's never over. I mean, I was blessed. I have fully recovered, but Many people I speak to were not as blessed, but yet they have been blessed with what they can do now. So I guess I live what I think, what I believe is that it's never over. Just you, when you think everything is over, I really truly believe that's the beginning. That's the beginning of the next. So that's what gets me up every morning, to find out what's happening next.
What a beautiful message. And again, I wanted to thank Dr. Mary McDonald for being here on the program, and thank you for joining us today, Dr. McDonald.
Thank you.
You are listening to the Journey to Success Radio Network. Find out more about the network, visit us at journeytosuccessradio.com. And we'll see you soon for our next amazing success story. Bye for now.